This is the audio podcast of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, D.C. Hi, I'm Grant Smith. Does anyone remember this?
The Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose serious consequences. The United States joins other nations in sending a clear message. We will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
Or what about this?
This month's lead story titled The Case for Bombing Iran. Mr. Podhoretz joins us now in the studio. Thank you so much for being our guest this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Podhoretz, in your article, you say there in fact is no other solution for the Iranian nuclear threat other than an American military strike.
Yes.
Have you told President Bush what you think?
Yes, I have.
Throughout the fall of 2007, pundits such as the so-called godfather of neoconservatism, Norman Podhoretz, fanned out and saturated the U.S. news media, urging the Bush administration to bomb Iran to wipe out what they repeatedly claimed was a robust nuclear weapons program. On October 21, 2007, Vice President Dick Cheney also appeared to lay down a gauntlet. However, the Israel lobby is now quietly apoplectic about the November 2007 National Intelligence Estimate released from the U.S. intelligence community. The NIE concludes that Iran almost certainly suspended its nuclear arms program in the fall of 2003, and that it's unlikely that Tehran is currently developing nuclear weapons. Today, we'll examine some of the run-up urging a strike, a military strike by the U.S. on Iran. But more importantly, we'll analyze some of the behind-the-scenes discussion at one of the Israel lobby's central think tanks.
Of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
The Washington Institute for Near East Policy was started up by Martin Indyk, an Australian national and U.S. naturalized citizen, who was former deputy director of research at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Indyk helped establish the Washington Institute in 1984 with the support of AIPAC board member and activist Barbie Weinberg. Weinberg had, quote, for over a decade privately wrestled with the idea of creating a foreign policy center. Although AIPAC doesn't list WINEP as an affiliate in its IRS filings, in the year 2004, 26% of AIPAC's board of directors were also trustees of WINEP. Let's listen in on a Washington Institute for Near East Policy conference held in December 4, 2007.
The United States and Israel have long shared a special relationship, but significant obstacles may exist to a substantive and comprehensive bilateral dialogue on issues related to the Iranian nuclear threat. On particularly sensitive issues, sovereign nations are loath to openly discuss their intentions and capabilities, even with their closest allies. If ever there were a test case for the strength of U.S.-Israeli relations, the Iranian nuclear program is that case. To mark the publication of a new Washington Institute policy focus, Speaking About the Unspeakable, U.S.-Israel Dialogue on Iran's Nuclear Program, by Chuck Frelick, the Institute invited the author and Jeffrey Kemp to address a special policy forum on December 4, 2007. Chuck Frelick, who teaches at Tel Aviv and Harvard Universities, is the Washington Institute's 2007 Ira Weiner Fellow. He has previously served as Israel's Deputy National Security Advisor for Foreign Affairs and as a senior analyst in Israel's Ministry of Defense. He is also currently a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Jeffrey Kemp is Director of Regional Strategic Programs at the Nixon Center, specializing in the growing role of China and India in the Middle East. During the administration of President Ronald Reagan, he served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the National Security Council. And now, Chuck Frelick.
Let me begin by saying a couple of comments about the new report. I think there's no doubt that for those of us who have worked on the Iranian issue for many years, it comes as something of a earthquake. After many years of bilateral U.S.-Israeli consultation on this issue, this is certainly a major change in the whole issue. something which potentially has overwhelming strategic importance for Israel, maybe somewhat less for the United States, but also a great deal of importance for the U.S. as well. Another level of dialogue might be on quasi-military operations. For example, a naval blockade. Israel would actually have no role of consequence in this, would want to be informed by the U.S. I don't think there's any problems to talk about that. Israel has no role. I don't think the U.S. would have a problem talking about this to Israel. The problem in dialogue arises when you start getting down the route, and the issue of military options arises, whether it's an American, an Israeli, a combined, a multinational operation, whatever it is. Then you start getting into the really difficult areas. Let's say that Israel believes that it does have an effective military option, and I'm not going to get into what effective means, but let's say Israel believes that it does have an effective option. Well, do you then come and talk to the United States about this? I think one of the main issues that any Israeli prime minister would ask himself is, well, am I assured of the answer that I want? And if I'm not assured of getting the answer I want, maybe I better not pose the question.
There's a palpable sense of sorrow in the fact that the campaign, the drive for U.S. military confrontation with Israel has been delayed. And I think the emerging theme that we'll hear repeated in other segments from the same conference is a vast sense of entitlement, throwing out policy options such as the U.S. naval blockade, and other entitlements that members of the audience who begin to ask panelists questions appear to have over U.S. Middle East policy formulation and the exertion of U.S. military might. This can be deduced from reading Washington Institute policy papers, but hearing it in the voices of guests and audience firsthand is chilling. Let's listen.
Thanks. I wonder if any of the panelists would care to address the question that I've already seen raised in the Middle East media, both Arab and Israeli, which is, has this change in the official American intelligence assessment derived really from some new intelligence or some better interpretation, or is it a reflection of some political or bureaucratic or policy maneuvers inside the U.S. administration? And if so, what does that tell us about the prospects for American-Israeli dialogue on this issue and for the overall credibility of American policy? Thank you.
Well, David, as I said, I think this is really a very interesting question. That's why I sort of said it's an 18-month period where something clearly changed. And until we know what those factors were, I mean, it's pure speculation. I mean, I think the other factor is that clearly the colossal mistakes made over Iraq have been the influencing factor in anything that's written about Iran. But I would have to think that this really is a new source of intelligence, because it is so counterintuitive to everything that has been said by the administration up to now.
And for the entitlement, there's a palpable sense that there is an entitlement to U.S. sources and methods of intelligence. We listen now to a discussion about how WINIP and presumably other factors in the Israel lobby will have to ultimately have access to raw intelligence in order to evaluate it and see if it measures up to their preconceptions or Israeli intelligence. However, it's this sense of entitlement that led to a jail cell for Jonathan Pollard and the upcoming April trial of two AIPAC lobbyists accused of violating the 1917 Espionage Act. And yet we hear no lessons learned from these two incidents.
Indeed, you'd think that there had been no NIE sanctions, the virtual economic blockade of Iranian financial transactions. Are they still on? This is the burning question of the editor of the AIPAC newsletter.
Rafi Danziger from AIPAC. I think one of the questions that arose from the NIE is what effect this will have on economic sanctions. Some might say that since now they are not working on a nuclear weapon, then you can relax and everything is going to be fine. And another school of thought would say that since NIE said that the reason that they stopped the program in 2003 was because of sanctions, therefore we need to continue with the sanctions or even perhaps toughen them further. And I would like to hear the opinions of both panelists, if possible, on what you think will happen to the sanction regime.
Rafi, I think it's absolutely predictable what will happen. Is the United States, the French, the British, and the Israelis will all argue that this clearly is a case for continuing sanctions and intensifying sanctions because they seem to work. The Russians, the Chinese, probably the Germans and the Italians will probably argue that there's much less case now for taking action immediately. So there'll be a split, and there'll be a split within Europe. So I don't think we'll see much traction, frankly, unless the French and the British go it alone.
Since I completely agree with that, there's no point in my restating. But
both you
hubris is the final factor that saturates the conference. What emerges is that, evidence or no, the Israel lobby will have to continue seeking U.S. punishment of Iran. Iran is believed to absolutely be determined to, quote, wipe
now,
Israel off the map, unquote.
You know, what leverage do we have on them? We have quite a lot of leverage on them if we were prepared to use it. The problem with this administration, quite frankly, is that it's never really decided how important this Iran issue is. I mean, if they had really put this at the top of the priority of our concerns, then we would have treated Russia very differently. But instead, this administration seems to have about four or five priorities and can never sort out which one's the most important. And until they work that out, the sort of the real-world trade-offs in terms of great power relationships don't happen. And we get bemused when the Russians start getting angry with us when we say we want you to help us with Iran, and then we send Dick Cheney to Vilnius to start vilifying Mr. Putin. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me geopolitically. But
this is the vocal expression of frustration with the U.S. failure to act on Israel lobby initiatives. Let's now listen to a full Fox News cut of what WINEP President Dennis Ross was urging before the NIE came out this fall.
The Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose serious consequences. The United States joins other nations in sending a clear message. We will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
Well, that was Vice President Dick Cheney, and his message to Tehran could not be any more clear. But how far will America actually go to make sure that Iran never actually gets its hands on a nuke? Joining us now is the author of Statecraft, How to Restore America's Standing in the World, former Special Middle East Coordinator and Fox News of Foreign Affairs Analyst, Ambassador Dennis Ross. Ambassador Ross is also a counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is where the Vice President delivered those remarks. Ambassador Ross, thanks so much for being here.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
That's the big question of the morning is, Vice President Cheney makes these remarks just on the heels of President Bush's remarks last week that we could be facing a World War III with Tehran if Iran gets the nuclear bomb. Is the White House trying to tell us something?
Well, the message is overwhelmingly powerful if you think about it. I mean, if the president says that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, it could be World War III, one would assume that that means we would do anything to prevent it. When the vice president later in the week, as of yesterday, says there'll be serious consequences and we will not allow Iran to have nuclear weapons, that again suggests the United States will go to any lengths, whatever is required, to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons. So these are extremely powerful words. They carry great meaning with them. Now what we'll have to see is what are the policies the administration is pursuing that reflect those words.
America's first president, George Washington, had a 7,641 word farewell address that he did not deliver, but rather had published
informally addressed to friends and citizens of the United States. Washington warned that the forces of geographical sectionalism, political factionalism, and interference by foreign powers in the nation's domestic affairs could threaten the stability and viability of the Republic. He urged Americans to exercise diligence in subordinating these forces to the common national interest. I'll read from that speech now. So likewise, a passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing of one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter, without adequate inducement or justification. It leads also to concessions to the favorite nation of privileges denied to others, which is apt doubly to injure the nation making concessions. Let's listen to the full segment of Norman Podhoretz.
The prestigious Guardian of Zion Award, conferred annually by the Bar-Ilan University Renat Center, will be bestowed this evening on distinguished author Norman Podhoretz, who is about to publish a new book titled World War IV. It will be published on 9/11. A founding editor of Commentary magazine, Podhoretz wrote this month's lead story titled The Case for Bombing Iran. Mr. Podhoretz joins us now in the studio. Thank you so much for being our guest this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Podhoretz, in your article, you say there, in fact, is no other solution for the Iranian nuclear threat other than an American military strike. Yes. Have you told President Bush what you think?
Yes, I have.
And what does he say?
He was very noncommittal, but he didn't say no.
Do you think he'll do it?
Yes, I do. I believe, contrary to what many people assume, that he will do it before he leaves office, possibly shortly before he leaves office. I think he agrees with the analysis that I offer, namely that there is no alternative to military action. Nothing else will stop them, not negotiations, not sanctions. There won't be an internal insurrection, at least in time. And I myself am skeptical of the estimates of the CIA and the IAEA, 3 to 5 years. The CIA's estimates on such matters have been wrong so often that they have very little credibility. And I think we have to assume the worst, namely that they're closer than these estimates suggest. And I believe that President Bush will not leave office with Iran in possession of a nuclear weapon.
You would like to see the United States take that action, but should Israel become involved and cooperate with the American military forces?
Well, tell you the truth, I don't know which would be the more desirable course. I think that it would be very difficult for Israel to pull off such an operation.
The Israel lobby wants the U.S. to attack Iran. Like Iraq, it does not matter whether there's solid intelligence that this country is a threat to America. Americans need to be vigilant and insist that the U.S. not allow the preconceived objectives of this lobby to find facilitating factors, propaganda, or phony crises to enable another calamitous tragedy in the region. Thank you for listening to the IRMEP podcast. To subscribe to a syndicated feed, visit www.irmep.org.